30, but let's count, you count all of those, right? But one research team at the Imperial College London, one bureaucrat at a world UN bureaucracy, essentially, two or three people at the NIH, right, and the CDC, would not have the ability to shut down the world. Now, here's the difficulty, is that there are two things happening simultaneously. There was what was happening in the US, right? There was this obvious dynamic, if you remember, between the media, who was thinking about an election that was coming up at the time, and wanted to do everything they could to make the current, the then president, look bad, and whoever the alternative was going to be, look good. That was true in the US. But that alone doesn't explain why it happened everywhere, right? So the fact that the media hated Trump doesn't explain why they locked down in Belgium, or in India, or in New Zealand, or Australia, or why they didn't lock down in fairly liberal Sweden, right? But they did lock down in the UK, which is led by Boris Johnson, member of the Tory party. Right? And so there was a weird kind of reality in that you had to realize, okay, there's a kind of local situation in which a lot of what was happening was brinksmanship between the left-wing media and Donald Trump. And the fact that it was also happening simultaneously everywhere. And that's what I mentioned at the very beginning. And so by itself, you would just have these public health officials and these scientists. But does anybody honestly know the name Anthony Fauci in 2019 that's in this room? A couple of you might have if you had followed, say, the AIDS crisis or something, or if you were in public health and were in Washington, D.C., but he's been working for the federal government for decades, right? And so the fact that you know his name is itself part of the story. Because what happened is, in a normal circumstance, what would happen is, so if you're the president of the United States, you are an executive of a massive organization, right? You've got these executive departments, and there are secretaries that head those, and then you've got all these executive agencies. So they're part of the executive part of the government, most of which are creatures of the 20th century. Most are creatures of the progressive movement, which thought that we could drastically increase the size of the administrative state, get a bunch of smart people, a bunch of scientists and engineers, and then they could manage and govern the country much more rationally than we can do it ourselves, right? So that's how you end up with these massive agencies. And so when you become the United States, when you become the president of the United States, you don't go out and hire a million people to work for you. What you have is a few thousand. Maybe, let's say 5,000 political appointees and different people that get to be hired, and then many, 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 many more that have been there for decades, right? And they pre-exist you, and they will probably outlast you. And so that's just the basic reality. And so if you're the president of the United States and there's a public health crisis, you consult the people that you have inherited. Right, but here's the difficulty, and if you study economics, there's a part of economics called public choice economics. And what you think of in economics is you think that economists analyze the incentives of customers and business people, like to Walmart and Target, and they're competing for customers. What public choice does is it studies the incentives of politicians and bureaucrats. And it turns out that if you're a bureaucrat, it doesn't mean that you're an evil person or that you don't care about other people, but your incentives are of a particular variety. And so your incentive is always going to be to make sure that your job is justified, right? So that you have something to do and that the budget that's allocated for whatever your job is gets spent, because if it doesn't get spent, it gets cut the next year, right? And so you're going to have a certain set of incentives, and it's going to be towards self-preservation. And so, but what normally happens is that you're president, something like this happens, you gather your cabinet and your relevant officials in the administrative arm of the government together, and they tell you what their advice is, right? Just like if you were going to make a military decision, you're going to talk to different advisors. And then you, as the people's representative, it is your job to make the prudential judgment in which you say, okay, this guy's telling me ought to do that, this guy's telling me ought to do that, and you've got to weigh all of those bits of advice off of competing and then make the call, right? And then we judge presidents and elected officials for doing that. And normally those people that advise them are nameless from our perspective, right? You don't know who the president's talking to from day to day and who these people are. And that's actually the way it should be, right? That's probably works really well. But what happens when the particular public health people that you've inherited, the officials, are elevated by the media to become the infallible oracles of science? Copyright. Science. It's capitalized. Right? Well, all of a sudden, that kind of normal process in which the president's having to make those decisions, it gets upended. It gets thwarted. Because the problem is that just because you're a scientist in the public health arm of an administrative agency in Washington, D.C., that's not like winning the gold medal of scientific genius. That's not what it means. The smartest guy that's ever existed on this question, and so he got this job. That's not how it works. You know, there are actually smart people that work at Oxford and Harvard and Yale and Stanford Medical School and other places like that that actually don't have a darn thing to do with the public health apparatus that can think about these things too. And in fact, they're independent. So imagine it's your job to tell the president, okay, there's this virus, and you've got to make the call. And so let's say you say, yeah, this is no big deal. Maybe 5 people will die, and 1 million people die. All right, you're looking for a job and for a bodyguard, right, in that scenario. But let's say you say, oh, 1 million people are going to die unless we do X, Y, and Z. And then you do X, Y, and Z, and only 1,000 people die. Then you can say, good thing we did X, Y, and Z. Or, well, better safe than sorry. Right? So you can see the incentives are always going to be toward catastrophe. Whereas if you were to, say, talk to independent scientists about these kinds of things that have independent jobs, you work for Stanford Medical School, and the president asks you, you're more likely, I think, to kind of call it like you see it. And so there's this problem now with the public health bureaucracy and that it's incentivized to do a particular thing. And I think it took our president about 6 months to figure that out. And so his instinct was, this seems sort of strange, but he ultimately, when push came to shove in April, March and April, as he took the advice of these people that he had inherited. Months later, he realized there's this really smart guy whose expertise is public health policy. His name was Scott Atlas, and he was at Stanford and the Hoover Institution. But it was months later. Now, those of us following it in March are thinking, why isn't Trump talking to Scott Atlas? Right? Why isn't he talking to Jay Bhattacharya at Stanford? These guys have got, they know the data and they tell him something different. And it took him a long time to sort of figure that out, because if you're in D.C., you're in the White House, you are just surrounded by this kind of apparatus. It's moving continually. And so what we had is this sort of weird dynamic, this blessing of federalism, and that the president actually has very limited emergency powers. So the president essentially doesn't have the authority to declare martial law in a public health emergency in the same way that state governors do. State governors generally do have temporary emergency powers like that. And that was really, really good in the case of the coronavirus, because what it meant is that, first of all, it couldn't ultimately be an entirely centralized solution, unlike other countries. So if you think it's bad here, I don't know if you notice what's happening in France, but hundreds of thousands of people are storming the streets in France. It is way worse there. It is way worse in Germany and in the UK and in Belgium. The places are like police states, and it's entirely centralized. Whereas in the United States, Montana was different from Nebraska, was different from Oklahoma and Florida and Massachusetts. And so that actually gives us a way to compare and contrast, right? Now, I'm not going to give you all the data on that tomorrow, but the nice thing is some states locked down, some didn't. Lockdowns happened at different dates, and we kept tracking the cases and the hospitalizations and the deaths, and we actually have a way to figure out whether the lockdowns made a difference or not, in part because of that kind of varied response. But out of all those, now there was lots of governors that I think responded, some responded much better than others. I think the one that responded by far the best was Governor Ron DeSantis of Florida. And he was the only one. He was amazing. And he's a very smart guy. Now, I'm convinced if you watch him, you guys go home tonight, go on YouTube, turn the sound off, and watch DeSantis, and tell me that he has not studied Donald Trump's hand signals, because he is doing all 75 of them. So he is doing this stuff. It's unbelievable. But you know what he did? He initially said, okay, we're supposed to lock down, we'll do that temporarily, and then he immediately contacted the scientists that were studying this in northern Italy and in the UK to find out what was happening. And DeSantis figured out, oh, it turns out this is really dangerous. If you are elderly and you have several comorbidities, you're much more at risk than if you're young. In fact, you're 1,000 times at more risk of death if you're old than if you're young. And so if you have two severe comorbidities and you're over 70, just a totally different deal, right? And so he says, guess what? You know, we should have a different response for different people depending upon their age, and that's what he did, right? And so, but he was able to, even though he had his own Florida public health people, right, he was able to actually reach out and talk to other scientists who are independent and was able to sort of overcome what was otherwise essentially a kind of a fishbowl of information. But what happened that made it actually very difficult for President Trump is that his officials got elevated to, as I said, this kind of infallible oracle. And so you had Dr. Fauci here, who became a sensation, a media sensation. You could see him on every Sunday talk show if you did that rather than going to church, which you shouldn't do, but a lot of people didn't watch him on Sunday, right? And so he became this media star, which is sort of strange, because he had a particular take on this. And not only that, but the media and the social media made a decision at this point that what the science would be whatever the officials said the science was. Right? Now, science is a particular institution and a particular set of methods in which we try to study the natural world and learn the truth about it. And it works really well when it's decentralized and different people are studying and they're arguing and they're debating. It does not work really well when it's centralized in this way, right? Because what happens is you get this intellectual orthodoxy and it freezes like plaster of Paris, and then it doesn't want to change, unfortunately. And that's unfortunately what happened. And so when we were working on the book, we had to observe really, really depressing things happen. And so, for instance, an important paper would be published in a relevant academic journal, The Lancet or the New England Journal of Medicine, that contradicted science, copyright, right? And you know what would happen? If you knew about the paper the first day, you'd see it. And then over the period of days, you'd watch Google bury it. It'd just disappear. So that you, before you'd be able to kind of just search for keywords, and before long, if you didn't know the exact name of the paper, you couldn't find the darn thing. Right, now this is absolutely terrifying, because the reason Google and the platforms got so big is that they were genuine neutral platforms. The reason Google was so awesome in 2001 is that it really was good at helping you find exactly what you wanted to look for, because it was organic, right? And it basically stored the information of other people doing the search, and it would preserve that. Well, at some point, Google decided they were going to start curating their content. Right, you're going to start manipulating it effectively like a publisher rather than a neutral platform. And they did that in spades when it came to this debate. So that information that you could know was wrong would end up sort of set in concrete if you were doing a Google search. Now, that wouldn't be a big deal if you knew, okay, I'm reading, this is the New Yorker, or I'm reading the New York Times, and now they have an editorial perspective. But people generally treat social media as if it's neutral. And so even, remember that 3.4% infection fatality rate I told you about a minute ago? That was the number that Neil Ferguson basically got from thin air in his computer model. If you ask Google as late as July of 2020, when we knew it was way below one-half of a percent, according to the CDC and the World Health Organization, you said, what is the infection fatality rate of COVID-19? It would give you 3.4% at Google. So it was just set in stone. And people think that that's just kind of the, you know, it's sort of the algorithm has delivered this message to you. Right? Now this was this combination of things that happened in which you have science officials who have a particular incentive to catastrophize. You have media which decides that it's going to make these officials the spokesman for the scientific evidence itself. Right? And that's the traditional media. And then you have social media, which are perceived to be neutral, manipulating the information to give that overwhelming perception. And not one person in 100, unless they were just following it full time, would be able to keep up with what exactly was happening. A lot of people have this sort of intuitive sense that something weird was happening. But to actually watch it happen, I can tell you, it was one of the most disturbing experiences of my entire life, to actually watch it happening in real time. And so what's weird is we talked about the media, but this is all transformed here in the last 20 years. And so remember, we have TV stations and we have print media, but the vast majority of information that people get from print media now comes online. And the vast majority of what they access of the online media comes from social media platforms. And so, for instance, if you're the New York Post, founded by Alexander Hamilton, and you happen to lay your hands on Hunter Biden's laptop, right? Social media can actually ban your account, which is what Twitter did. It's utterly extraordinary, and basically kill the story, right? Because we've completely reoriented the way in which we're able to consume information. And so again, what I want you to see is that what's weird is that we had this moment of the kind of democratizing force of social media being controlled, it turns out, just by a few people, right? So that you get a few people, a few scientists well-placed, a few public health officials well-placed, a few social media platforms well-placed, and then what you have is a kind of convergence toward a particular narrative. So that we had this massive social media boosting, and this is what made absolutely everything different. Because the wisdom in media for decades has been, if it bleeds, it leads. In other words, nobody wants a story, right? Pretty much everybody's healthy again today in Billings, just like they were yesterday. That is a really boring headline, right? Nobody wants to hear that. It's news because it's some new thing that's out of the ordinary. And so if it's something sensational or terrifying, the media is going to do that, because if it bleeds, it leads. But before, our access to media was somewhat isolated. We didn't have access to it. It wasn't continually bombarding us. But with social media, as I said a minute ago, right, we all have access to these devices. So the first iPhone, this is the iPhone 11, so I'm behind now, because the 13, I think, just came out. So the first one of these was released in June of 2007, not that long ago. None existed until 2007. Now 3.5 billion people on the planet have smartphones, right? And this is not just text, and it's not just audio. It's HD video that we access in real time, and that's delivered to us through these particular social media platforms. As a result of this is a former health minister in Israel. He said, the coronavirus is the first virus with public relations. He was staggered by the way in which this became a social media phenomenon. So the social media platforms actively censored people, including experts. That's what's weird about this. It wasn't like there was a scientific consensus and then, you know, some kind of cranky guys that had the other side of the story. There's people like Jay Bhattacharya, right, at Stanford, and Professor Gupta. These are people I've talked to at Oxford, right? Martin Kulldorff at Harvard were censored because they didn't toe the official party line. And they've all turned out to be right. So the official party line, as more details have come out, have realized they sold us a bill of goods. No one's yet been held to account. And actual smart officials in highly credentialed and prestigious institutions found themselves removed from YouTube and Twitter and Facebook. That is an extraordinary thing. And we've got to figure out how to live in a world in which that happens, in which information can be transmitted in that way. And then finally, we dealt with a weird sort of thing having to do with statistics. And the best we could come up with in the book is to call it a case-demic. And so if you remember the discussion, like, okay, think for a minute, what is a case exactly? So if you have a case of the flu, what is a case exactly? Well, the way a case, if you would add, say, 2019, what is a case of the flu? Well, that's someone that gets the flu, so they're infected, they're symptomatic, and they're sick enough that they go to the emergency room or to the doctor, and then they're tested, and it's triggered in the system as flu, and then they're treated, right? So they're infected, they're symptomatic, they're so sick that they have to be treated, then they're tested, and then they're treated. That's a case, all right? Now, that's how the case started, but very quickly what happened with COVID-19 is that that's not what a case was. A case was a positive test. And so you can be asymptomatic. Now, normally, people that are asymptomatic, you don't get tested. It's not like, you know, I feel really good, but I think I'm going to go to the emergency room and get a flu test. Let's just, you know, I don't know, I just should do that. Nobody does that. Right? But if you do that, for whatever reason, you decide you're going to retract this, then what you're going to do is, let's assume that the test is perfect, right? So there's no false positives and no negatives. Let's just assume it's perfect. You're going to pick up a whole bunch of infections that aren't actually cases because they're asymptomatic, right? Because the set of people infected is always going to be much larger than the set of people that has been tested and verified to be infected, which is going to be a larger set than the people that also have all those things and they're sick and need to be treated. But we had the earlier sort of version of case in our minds, a sick person in the hospital. So that when the definition effectively changed overnight and no one was told, once massive testing started happening, and this was maddening because we were writing the book while this was happening, while the testing was going online, and nobody was paying attention. So we initially did threw pressure on hospitals in New Jersey and in New York and a little bit in Florida, and then all of a sudden everybody forgot that. Right, and summer happened and all the testing was going, and then we started just focusing on infections that were tested positive and calling them cases. Right, and that is an absolute disaster because the numbers then got completely muddled. And I'm not even going into the complexities of the tests themselves. I'm saying assume that they were perfect and there were no false positives and false negatives. Now we do know, and most of you probably know, that this particular type of test called a PCR, because of the way it works, essentially, it picks up pieces, viral particles, effectively. It has to effectively amplify the sample in order to be able to detect it. And so you don't want to over-amplify the sample or you'll be picking up broken fragments that don't actually tell you anything. And so in other words, if you cycle it too many times, you'll generate too many false positives. That was a problem. But that's a separate problem from the fact that we were just calling mere positive test cases, right? And so as a result of that, we got focused on cases. And so inevitably, if that's what you're focusing on, if a case is a positive test and you're amplifying the number of tests you do per day, guess what? You're going to increase the number of cases because it's an artifact of doing the testing on asymptomatic people. Right, and so this went on, unfortunately, for months. It eventually kind of worked itself out, but most people don't even realize that that's what actually was happening. And so it actually was really, really, really hard to figure out what was happening with the numbers. Now, the good news is the CDC, eventually the numbers sort of settled down, but there's a lag at the CDC because of the way this stuff is counted. And so it was always about 6 weeks after the fact before you figure out what was going on. But having the news 6 weeks after the fact is really not useful for the daily news cycle, right? So CNN is going to say, we don't know what the number of deaths and cases are today, but we'll wait 6 weeks to tell you. And so what we had is about a half a dozen real-time tickers of cases and hospitalizations and deaths, which had never before happened. And so what we had is an excessive noticing. And so now think about this, because there are tens of thousands of people that die every day, every year of the flu. There are hundreds of thousands of people that die of heart disease, of pneumonia and respiratory disease, right? And cancer. Now, but imagine if you were looking on your computer screen at every cancer death every minute. That would have a way to freak you out, right? It's like if you're a day trader, you're watching your stock go up and down. It just drives you crazy. You don't want to do that. We were all doing that, and we had these websites that were sort of tracking that stuff, and we didn't have perspective. Because you really don't know, okay, it's 100 deaths from this. How does that figure? How many people die every day? I don't know, right? You need to know that, and you need to know that And the reason is because we are all mortal. And so we all die, right? So the number of people that are born, right? So accepting Jesus, right? And the Enoch, there's a couple of exceptions, right? But for the most part, the number of people born, the number of people that die is the same, and with a lag, right? And so we all die of something. And so epidemiologically, it really, really matters when you're talking about a disease to know, okay, what's the average age of death for that disease, right? But if you're not tracking that, in fact, what you should be tracking is life years to really get nailed this down tight. So that, but now, what is a life year? A life year is essentially, if you, public health officials do this, you'll say, okay, something happened and there were a million life years lost as a result of that. Okay, now, so that might be that there were a million people that died a year earlier than they would have, right? Or there might be 100,000 people that died 10 years earlier than they would have. And we all know it's tragic for anyone to die of cancer, but why do we think it's more tragic for a 5-year-old to die of cancer than for an 85-year-old? It's not because young people are more valuable than old people. That's the wrong answer. Okay, the answer is that we know for each of us, we know we're going to die, and it would be more tragic for us to die early in our lives than close to the time in which we were likely to die anyway, right? So the problem is that politicians weren't good at explaining this, and so they got on the news and they said, well, it's old people dying. It sounds like, what are you saying? That doesn't matter? Now, because it's complicated, but their point was, right, is that a virus matters whether it's killing people that are 5 years old or it's killing people, right, within a year of when they would have died anyway. Because did you know that a large segment of us in this room is going to die of a respiratory illness? A bunch of us, we're going to get old and you get infirm, and the thing that kills you very often, if you don't die of cancer or one of these other traditional things, is you get a cold, or you get the flu, and you get pneumonia, and that's what kills you, right? And so it's that same segment, that same kind of ecosphere, right, that COVID-19 occupied. And weirdly, the flu seems to have disappeared. We don't know why that is, right? But the average life expectancy of COVID-19 is pretty darn close within a year of the average life expectancy. The average life expectancy, all right? And so that's just a huge factor when you're thinking about public health and what you do about it and who you focus your attention on, right, like Ron DeSantis do. And so the idea is, oh, let's make little kids who are at very little risk, let's torment them and make them be on Zoom and wear masks. Right, and use up all of our energy on that and just treat them exactly the same as people that are in nursing homes who are actually at risk. This is completely insane. Right? It's completely insane. And it was the result of just simply not waiting and saying, okay, let's learn everything that we can about this thing and not be carried away by this kind of social contagion that unfortunately we're still in. We're still in it. And it's a result of this kind of information explosion in which you can explain every step of it in terms of natural incentives of public health officials and people that are in newsrooms and the people that curate content on the internet. But you can understand every step and why people did what they did. But the net result was the greatest social contagion in history. And for good and for ill, we are living through it. And with that, I think we will end and maybe take a few questions and then call it a night. Thank you very much.
If you have a question, wait for the mic, please.
Yeah, Jane. I'm thinking of this from kind of an economics perspective. Mm-hmm. I like markets.
Yep.
I'm very suspicious of, well, not suspicious, because some regulation is necessary, depending on what we're talking about. Mm-hmm. But just referring to what you've been talking about tonight, one of the things that's been coming up that I'm seeing is the regulation of social media.
Yeah.
Do you have any thoughts on where this might be going and what ought to be happening?
I do. It's a very complicated story, and there are about six traditional ways of responding sort of historically. If you say, okay, so what are the kinds of things that the government does? So the worry is, here's the kind of intuition, is that there are certain companies that seem to be not only large, but be unjustly using their size, right, to sort of manipulate us. And so one way in which the government has responded to this is in terms of what's called antitrust, which just basically means break up companies that are too large. Now, there's a bunch of, it's the sort of thing that sounds nice at the beginning, but what actually happens, first of all, what does it mean to be too large? Do we want a country in which basically we punish businesses that get too big if they've gotten big because they were successful, right? In which case, we basically punish domestic industry if it gets too successful, right? That's a kind of, we don't want to do that. The other thing is that the law on antitrust, the only way you can be sort of dinged for antitrust is if you do things that are anti-competitive. So in other words, if I'm an oil company and I collude with another oil company to control prices, that I'm doing something against the interest of the consumer. I don't think there's any case for that at all. And so I don't think there's a couple of senators that are talking about antitrust thing. I think it's all chest thumping. It doesn't make any sense. And I think it'll waste us a bunch of money and time. Besides which, what does that mean? So they're going to break up Facebook. So now you can only be on Montana Facebook? I mean, what is it going to be, right? It's not at all. I have no idea what that's going to be. And so we want to be careful not to do things that are sort of are emotionally satisfying to talk about, like blow them up, right? I've got a friend who's running for office right now. Yeah, let's just tear them apart limb from limb, you know. I honestly think that the solution is going to be found in this very obscure Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act of 1996. And there's a great book called is it the 26 words that invented the internet? I just read it a couple of weeks ago. And so what this was in 96, this was the era of AOL and CompuServe, right? So Google didn't even exist. Facebook didn't exist. And so people were saying, okay, there's this nascent industry growing, and there are going to be these great sort of internet platforms, and it's going to be an American dynamo, and we're going to dominate this industry. We don't want to kill it, right? So they're saying, we don't want a regulation that makes it impossible for these things to develop. On the other hand, we don't want porn to proliferate that kids can have access to. So this is part of the Communications Decency Act. And so what Section 230 does is it says, essentially, the neutral platforms can't be sued for libel for things that are said by others on their platform. So if I say something libelous on Twitter about someone else, that person can sue me, they can't sue Twitter. All right, and the reason is that if you could sue the platform, then the platforms are going to be like a publisher, constantly controlling what's on it. And at the same time, the platforms are allowed to regulate content reasonably to prevent indecency, effectively. So basically, they're going to be neutral platforms, and so you can't sue them for libel because they're not publishers. Nevertheless, they're allowed to moderate content, really, for porn. So you see how, so it's totally logical. And in fact, guess what? All the big tech companies are in the United States and not in Europe because they have different regulations in Europe in which you can sue the platforms over there. And so, but here's the problem, is that the platforms started as neutral platforms and they became publishers. So they're now moderating content, not for indecency, but basically for politics. So Google and Twitter and Facebook are functioning in many ways like the New York Times and NPR. Right? And now if the New York Times publishes something by a columnist that's libelous, they get dinged for it because they're a publisher. And so I think regulatorily, the most likely solution is going to have to do with that Section 230. The question is whether there's enough space in it now that platforms could basically be sued for not remaining neutral platforms, or does it need to be slightly moderated? But I actually think there's a huge amount of noise. There's about six suggested regulations. I haven't gone through all of them, and that's the only one that I think is likely to make a difference.
So is DeSantis on the right track?
I think he is, but at the moment, people are sort of feeling their way around on this.
All right.
Yeah, now DeSantis and some of the governors are trying a different thing in which they're saying, okay, the federal government can't do this, but the state, so that's going to get decided in courts whether states can actually do this. It's a great question.
Jay did a great job on laying out the evolution of the pandemic and how it's being used.
Mm-hmm.
as a fear-mongering process globally. I came across an article the other day that a white paper that was produced by John Casey of NASA, mm-hmm. and that pretty much seemed to totally dispel the possibility of the modules, the models that were used to depict right. global warming. Any comments on that with regard to that being the second horse out of the chute
yes.
to do that job for the progressive globalists?
Yeah, so you got to come tomorrow because that's my fourth lecture. I'm not going to tell you what I'm going to say. That was what was on my computer that I couldn't get to start at 5:45. So, so the globalists were after my hard drive. No, actually, I think it's me not. It's me using a six-year-old computer.
Doctor, you've very well explained just now Section 230 mm-hmm. and what the governors can do. Hopefully, tomorrow you're going to wind up with saying whatever we can do.
Absolutely. That's what we're going to end on. And so all I've done is sort of lay out and diagnose. Tomorrow we're going to talk about the evidence. I want you guys to know what the kind of reasons that people had initially among epidemiologists for what the right response was, what the evidence for lockdowns were, what the evidence is that they actually worked, and then what the actual cost of the responses were, and then what the heck we can do to keep this from happening again. Oh, and then the fourth talk is going to be about the Great Reset and those who would like to continue doing this for other reasons. All right, so any more questions? Okay, so. Dick told me everyone starts flagging if you go to 9, so I'm just making sure we don't go to 9. I'm going to flag because I'm on the East Coast.
I'm a member of the City Council here in Billings, and whenever the pandemic was really at its height, we were getting a report from our public health officer every other week, and he did a lot of statistics and charts and whatever. And now, since it's starting to reemerge, we're getting statistics again. Mm-hmm. And so my question is, because I've raised the question, you know, as a public health official, is he only allowed to give CDC information? Mm-hmm. Because there's other good science right. out there, as you mentioned. And so I think what, as a city official, I'm up against, without looking like I have 10 foil antennas out here,
right.
is, you know, why can't we have a balanced conversation? And Dick was the one that brought it up.
Yeah.
He was there. And so I kind of stuck my neck in the noose the next week and mm-hmm. asked that question and have yet to get that response other than silence from our more progressive council members.
Right.
Because that's what they look at. And they say, well, those are the numbers. You yeah. see the numbers.
Right, that's
but,
right.
But they are skewed in their favor. Well, that I don't know how to
well, this is, so this is the way I would put it. You don't even need to dispute whatever the numbers are. You need to know what they're probably maybe pointing at cases that are happening in the area or maybe hospital beds or something like that. That's not the question. The question is, are the proposed policies going to help hurt or do nothing? And so what they want you to do is not ask that question, right? They don't want to say, okay, so what evidence is there that lockdowns actually reduce the numbers of people that go into hospitals or that get respiratory virus? That's the question. And so there, it's almost like something happened in which we lock everyone down, healthy, sick, and otherwise, as if from time immemorial that's been the way that we've responded to respiratory viruses. It's not. It's never been the way that we've done this. And in fact, the reason respiratory viruses get bad in the winter in the north and bad in the summer in the south is guess what people are doing? They are inside. So if you're, this is hard maybe, if you live in the north, you don't, you wonder why is everybody getting it down there in Florida in July? Go to Florida and you'll know why. You're inside, right? And in Montana and in Michigan in the winter, you're inside. And so it's not intuitively obvious that making people stay inside together is the right response. And you will get stone silence if you ask that question. I want the empirical evidence that the lockdowns are going to solve this problem. And I want you to show me the World Health studies that establish that. Show it to me. You won't, I promise you, you're not going to get an answer. You might get accused of the tinfoil hat. Don't dispute the numbers, because that's the question is not, is the virus dangerous or are people getting sick? The question is, what do we do about it? What's going to help? And the problem for a year and a half is we've been advised to do stupid stuff that doesn't help. That's the issue. It's just like if somebody says, well, I want to take all the money from the rich guys and give it to poor people because they're poor people. You say, well, we should help poor people. Why do you think that's going to work, right? In the same way, the lockdowns, there needs to be really good evidence, right, that those actually help before we should incur the obvious human and social cost of them. And that's what everybody's got one tool in their toolbox now, right? Public health officials, it's more lockdowns. All the very smart scientists of the Great Barrington Declaration all believe in the coronavirus. They think it's deadly. They think there should be a public health response. They just think there's no evidence that lockdowns work, and there's a lot of evidence that they harm. That's the key thing. So yeah, so don't even spend time. It's true that the numbers can be squirrely, but I would just advise don't even focus on that. Focus on the policies and make them justify the policies. So on that note, okay, we got one more and then that'll be it.
So is it Ferguson that created the predictive model?
Neil Ferguson is the head of the team at the Imperial College London that developed the computer model that I was talking about.
So how does he become the go-to source, especially with
Yeah, so he's the go-to source because he's always right, he's always wrong in the right direction, as we say in the book. That's the easiest answer. And so, remember I talked about the incentives in public health, is that if you overestimate, all right, and then it's an overestimate, you don't tend to get punished, because people are sort of, oh good, I'm glad that it didn't kill 100 million people. And so he is always wrong in the right direction. And so even in this case, he did not suffer any negative consequences until he had this little mishap with his mistress. So, it's a perfect example of the incentives, unfortunately, in public health. So with that happy note, we will end until tomorrow morning. Thanks so much.